on facebook.com/stageletterinstudio or tweet me at @StageLetterNStudio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
Hi, this is Justin Miller, KBOO's underwriting coordinator. Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KBOO. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kboo.fm/underwriting, by email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
Tuesday nights on KBOO, it's Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush.
With DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid.
10 p.m. to midnight.
2 hours of global bass featuring Bhangra, Bollywood,
and the urban sounds of the global diaspora. You're done north!
Do you worry that corporate power is totally out of control? Tune into the KBOO Evening News every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. beginning August 5th to hear the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'll be sharing stories about communities that are rising up against corporate control and passing laws that exercise their right to govern themselves. That's every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News beginning August 5th. Don't miss it.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Jeffrey Thomas. He's a gallerist who has recently returned to the scene in Portland, and he has a new show called The Sum of Its Parts, Part 2, which runs March 25th through May the 9th at Jeffrey Thomas Fine Art. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Jeffrey.
Oh, it's great to be here, Joseph. Thanks for having me.
You've been around a bit. But we're going to talk about your new show, which is the part two of the Sum of Its Parts. And it's a dozen artists, from mostly local, and they're showing at your gallery space, which is at 2219 Northwest Raleigh. So you're back on the scene. What kind of impact are you trying to make with this show?
Well, this is a dream come true after 22 years. I left the art business in 1992 in New York City with two beautiful little babies in my arm and came back to Portland to get a real job and worked in advertising and photo production for all that time. And when my youngest child graduated in June, I turned to my wife. I said, I think we've just graduated and I'd like to get back into what I was doing 22 years ago. So the search began for a situation where I could find a gallery space. And of course, things have changed a lot in 22 years in terms of finding available space. And Portland is really recognized, I think, and emblematic for its collaborative energy. It's what really differentiates it, say, from Brooklyn for me. And so I found a collaborative partner with Marilyn Murdoch and Murdoch Collections and Katayama Framing up at 2219 Northwest Raleigh. And so we have three art service related businesses: framing, secondary market resale, and then my art advisory and brokerage gallery. And we thought, well, now we're creating a destination that is more than the sum of its parts, we hope. A reason for people to visit us up in that nook of what is going to be called slab town.
That little nook has, St. Jack's, a new restaurant, yeah. and a yoga place next door.
Yeah,
and
George Moreland across the street for all your plumbing needs.
Yeah.
and, of course, a new Seasons is coming in, which always comes in advance of massive condo buildings. So we're looking forward to a whole new neighborhood springing up in the next few years.
Well, I was at the opening of the Sum of Its Parts, Part 1, and there was a great crowd there. Some of those artists are showing again in Part 2. So the concept is holism, right?
Right. We looked at this business collaboration as the sum of its parts. This really comes from Aristotle's concept from the 4th century Metaphysica, the truism that the whole is sometimes greater than the sum of its parts. And we thought, well, this business is going to be better than the individual businesses. And I thought, well, let's do a show like that. Let's look at artists from around the country who work with the idea of using components or layers, repetition of objects to make a complete and engaging work of art. So that is how we came up with some of the parts. And then I thought, well, you can't do a show without two parts if it's going to be called the sum of its parts. So we did part one and part two. Now, part two, which opens this week, is the same artists, more or less, as in part one, but it's a different piece in a different location. So it's sort of like a choir that I've put together, and it's doing a second song. Not just one.
So if an artist was near the window the first time, they're in another place. It's
right.
The same gallery, right?
Same gallery,
yeah.
Different artists, different place, and maybe a different kind of piece. It's not like a Where's Waldo necessarily, but hopefully people who come in will be engaged and excited by what they see.
The postcard image is by Brad Johnson, and it looks like a collage of photos of nature scenes, cliffs, or a stream bed. What does he do?
Well, Brad Johnson is an artist who also left his painting career to have a whole second life for 20 years. So we actually are we all kind of track similarly. He left his business, sold his business a few years ago and got back into painting. And so when I visited his studio, I was fascinated to see these eight pieces pinned up to the wall. They are the Mount St. Helens series. And what Brad does is he hikes into the St. Helens crater, which is an arduous and long trek. He then takes these photographs, takes them back to the studio, prints them out on archival paper, and then repositions them into a collage, and then coats them with paint and pigment to kind of signify the kind of toxic, steamy, acidic quality of that hissing crater.
You're allowed in there?
Yeah, well, he's got in there, yes, with some volcanologists.
He's
very interested in the geology. Yeah, and, you know, this area we live in, the land has influenced all of us for 10,000 years. It's an amazing part of the world. It's why we all live here. But we have, in the Native American or First People artwork, some of the most rich graphic carved masks and totems and ritual objects and blankets in the world. And that tradition, that pictorial tradition, continues today. It's a land of plenty.
Some of these names have been around for a while. Sean Healy.
Yep. The gallery is, I'm doing a different model. When William Jameson and I had the gallery years ago, Jameson Thomas, like a lot of galleries in Portland, the focus is on representation of an artist's career. I didn't want to do that for two reasons. First is I didn't want to compete with all my friends who have galleries. I wanted to collaborate with them. I didn't want to compete. That, again, is that Portland thing. And I also felt that they were doing such a good job that I needed to come up with a new business model or a new model of gallery. And so what I'm doing is I'm visiting artist studios and selecting emerging artists. I'm picking work from several galleries that I think are showing very interesting artists. I'm bringing in New York work to create a context for a lot of the Portland artists. And then I'm showing underrepresented artists, artists who no longer are showing with galleries. So it's a real mix, but I'm not doing one-person shows. The shows last a little longer. And because I don't collect one person, I I'm interested in collecting a lot of different people. I wanted to show that in the gallery. I wanted to show artists who might not otherwise be seen together.
Mm-hmm. How is that not cherry picking? If you get Sean Healy's work, he's showing with Elizabeth Leach.
That's exactly what it is. I'm cherry picking. That's the model. I want people to know when they come to Jeffrey Thomas Fine Art, they're going to see the best examples by the artists I think are the most interesting and engaging. So it's very much a curatorial point of view. And yes, cherry picking is exactly what I want, because I don't want to waste people's time. I want them to see the best work that's out there.
But their regular galleries allow that?
Well, I've worked out arrangements with all of them. I mean, these are people that I've known, and in some cases, Charles Froelich and Jane Beebe worked for Jameson Thomas. Mm-hmm. So we go back a long way, and I really want to champion their programs, again, without competing or stepping on them. This is not a town where you're going to get rich as an art dealer. It's a town where we can really celebrate the extraordinary talents that are here and have chosen to make their artist practices located here.
Mm-hmm. Heather Hutchison, tell us about Heather.
Well, I showed Heather in New York back in the late 80s and early 90s, and it's a real joy to come back 22 years later and revisit the careers now of some of these artists who've moved on to bigger and much better things. Heather is a New York artist. She's known for working with sort of boxed light. She's very interested in how we perceive light, and she makes these extraordinary constructions that seem to hold different colors of light as they move throughout the day. I find them very spiritual pieces, and of course, her work is very minimal, so she needs a lot of space around the pieces for them to be effective.
And the concept, her piece in this part two show is a play on, it uses the light coming from the window.
Right. I mean, here's an example of an artist who doesn't have any pieces. The piece is a complete whole, but it needs a large white wall for the colors on the interior to reflect. And it needs daylight so that the passage of light throughout the day will alter the piece. So in that case, you need light plus white wall plus Heather Hutchison's piece. That's, mm-hmm. Those are the three parts. Otherwise, you don't have a complete experience.
And these, usually she does things like rectangles, triangles.
Yeah, very geometric.
Are these canvases or are they painted wood?
Well, that's a very good question. They're actually, they're constructions of framed wood that she then layers plexiglass and encaustic over. These are in her older pieces, and in her newer pieces, she's working with Pantone chips and flash paint on the back of that to create kind of a juxtaposition of color.
Yeah, at part one, her pieces, they looked like little Perspex boxes, and everyone's trying to get up really close to them to see what was reflecting backwards onto the wall.
That's my biggest worry, is that sometimes people have tried to figure out how is this done? Uh-huh. You know, it's sort of like a good frame. You should never really notice the frame. You should notice the artwork. And with Heather's work, of course, I would like people to experience the sort of mysterious light rather than, hey, how's that done?
Right. So. Ben Buswell's in the show.
Yes.
We've had Ben on here before.
Yeah, Ben is, I think, an artist that everyone's looking at right now. He shows with Up 4 Gallery. Like Brad Johnson, he's manipulating photos, but he's including it in a process that is both very idea-driven and the hand of his, I mean, he takes a photo and he'll slice it thousands of little mm-hmm. cuts.
With an X-Acto?
Right, with a blade, exactly. And I'm not really drawn to photography unless it's been abused or the hand of the artist has taken something to it. So, again, I think work that is made by people, just like music, the vibrations of the artists are manifested in that piece, are contained in that piece, just like all those songs are in Willie Nelson's guitar.
Ben Buswell's work, he takes like an image of water and scratches it a lot. And so you're sort of drawn into it and it becomes quite abstract. How, you know, in your career, what has happened to abstraction? Has it become, is it like jazz? It had its moment, but now like jazz continues. What is the nature of abstraction these days?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, as I get older, actually, I'm less drawn to narrative or figurative work, things that describe or represent things. I mean, that has been done, and it's been done so well for centuries. But, you know, as I come down the other side of the mountain, as you were, as I get older and not a lot of time left, I'm much more drawn to, I would say, things that are ambiguous or suggestive or ask me as a viewer, doesn't tell me. I don't need to be told anything anymore. And abstract work has not lost its power as a result. Now, there is abstraction from, you know, very emotional abstraction for, say, abstract expressionism, where you just let it all slather all over that canvas and, you know, let her rip. That's less interesting to me than the kind of work of Heather Hutchison or Ben Buswell, which is quieter work, but it demands that you pay a little more than, you know, a nanosecond to get it. And it changes. Your moods change and throughout the day, and your relationship with this work changes. I think that's exciting. So abstraction has not disappeared. It will continue to be a fundamental food group in the art world forever.
Mm-hmm. If, let's say, somebody gifts you a really good abstract painting and you live with it and you see new things in it often, but you don't have art critical tools, you don't have the vocabulary or the training, do you think what you get out of that painting is valid?
That's a great question, Joseph. And let me give you my take on this. You know, art is, theoretically, it's a noun. But really, art is a verb. Art is the place between you and the event, if it's a time-based performance, or you and the object, if it's a spatial experience. It's that place between you and that thing. It's a personal relationship. And I don't think you need to have any art history to get that experience. You just have to be open, you have to be curious, and you have to be quiet. And the more you know about art history, or the more you know about critical theory, the more you can talk about it. But that talk is cheap. And I really think, you know, the work, first of all, I think there is work that is heavily theoretical or conceptual, and I don't really think of that. If you don't have an immediate visual connection, if when you look at something, there is nothing there and someone has to hand you a thesis to understand it, well, that's really a visual example of philosophy or theory. That's not fine art. Mm-hmm. You know, art doesn't need that explanation. It should be immediate. It should be apparent. It should relevant. Yes, the more you know, the more you know, the more perhaps that will backstory or fill in that backstory. But really, the experience is the engagement. And it's just like music. There's music, food. I mean, everything is everything. Everything is like everything else. So the relationship we have with food that we love, company that we keep, countries we visit, art that we love, it's all about manifesting this extraordinary experience called life.
Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing you don't know till you've lived a bit, right?
Yeah.
You can't really know that when you're 20, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, when I was, I worked in, as I was coming up in New York City as a kid, I worked as an intern at a large gallery in New York. And my father, who was curator of early Flemish painting, would ask me, you know, Jeffrey, you're 20, what is turning you on? And I would just go rave about surrealism and Dali and Max Ernst. And, oh, you know, it's just so crazy. I mean, a melting clock. And, you know, and my father would just look at me and go, Jesus, you know. He says, what do you think of, you know, Donatello or Bellini? And I would say, oh, come on. I mean, how many pictures of a guy with arrows in him can you possibly look at? And, in fact, now that I'm older and perhaps not much wiser, surrealism doesn't hold any interest in me. It's sort of thin. You know, it's curious. But I do understand the pain and the agony and the spiritual doubt that some of these old masters were trying to convey in these Renaissance paintings, which I didn't get when I was 20. And experiences worn me down to be accessible.
What kind of music do you listen to?
Oh, man, I listen to everything. I've been listening to cable, you know, for years and years, for decades. This is a great music town, and I, a few years ago, started this is a note to everybody out there, you can learn new things. I taught myself to play guitar. Of course, when I come out on the front porch with my guitar, my neighbor slams the door, but I'm having a good time.
Acoustic guitar?
Yeah, acoustic guitar. And
how
so
did you do it? Like kids do it today? They go on YouTube and they learn something on the
Well, isn't that funny? No, I had heard that the way they taught guitar in Canada was to use a four-string baritone ukulele. It's not a ukulele at all. It's really a small four-string guitar. I don't know why they call it a ukulele at all. It's nothing to do with the three little ukuleles. But, you know, it's two-thirds a guitar, so it was two-thirds easier. And I started with that and, you know, eventually added the extra two strings and off I went. So I'm drawn to songwriting.
Did you have a teacher?
Oh, no, I taught myself.
From a book?
Yeah, picture book, like a real idiot. But man, I'm never happier than when I'm sitting on that front porch playing a song and singing at the top of my voice. It's just the best. And unfortunately for my neighbors, perhaps not the same experience for them.
So what do you listen to apart from everything?
Well, because I'm playing guitar, I get to learn about who are great songwriters. You know, Bob Dylan, obviously. There's a guy in Iowa, Greg Brown, who has come to Portland, has a wonderful following here. He's direct. Michael Hurley. Michael Hurley's one of the great American songwriters and has settled in Portland. When you have somebody who can have a turn of phrase that is profound and stays with you and you can reinterpret in a song, those are the songwriters I really do appreciate. Now, you know, we were talking about seeing the Grateful Dead in 1974 at the Paramount here. You know, my first concert was the Monkees, and guess who opened for the Monkees? Jimi Hendrix. Get him off the stage and bring out the Monkees. He joined the tour briefly, and I didn't last long.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Jeffrey Thomas. His show, The Sum of Its Parts, Part 2, is on from March 25th through May 9th at his new gallery, Jeffrey Thomas Fine Art, at 22nd and Raleigh in Northwest. Jeffrey, just give us a bit of the backstory of you. You mentioned your father was a curator. Where was that?
I came along, I think, a little unexpected. My father was still in college. He then went to the Metropolitan Museum in New York as an assistant curator for Flemish painting. And once I arrived and my brother 10 months later, sort of like my experience, he had to put the kibosh on his first love and ended up moving to work in the financial sector to support his growing family. And there would be brothers and sisters to follow. My father, who I adore and has been a great influence, was that first influence. And then when my mother remarried, she married up-and-coming young actor in 1960 named Dennis Hopper. We moved to Los Angeles, and my mother had met at the Actors Studio, Lee Strasberg's Method Acting Studio. And classic Hollywood story, we had just arrived in 1960, and Dennis was on a Western with an old-time director. The director said, "Hopper, I want you to go over there 10 steps and turn around and say your line." And true method actor Dennis said, "My character wouldn't do that, man." And so 2 days later for this one scene, he was promptly blackballed. And that was the end of Dennis's career until Easy Rider 10 years later. So my mother had given him a camera, and we became kind of our home became kind of a hub for a lot of the art scene that was going on in the 60s, you know, a lot of pop artists, a lot of studio visits. It was very exciting for a young kid to be dragged around to all these events. I have to say that Portland now, with its sort of frugal support of the arts, reminds me a little bit of Los Angeles in the 60s. Because there isn't a driven market here selling art left and right, a lot of artists are free to kind of experiment and do things they would never otherwise perhaps risk. And I think it's a very exciting time for Portland, much as it was in the 60s in Los Angeles.
Your history is with William Jameson. You had that really was the kind of art gallery of Portland. And, you know, we can see what's shaken out from that. Some of the same people are now have their own galleries. How's the relationship between the wealthy people in Portland who buy art and the galleries? How has that changed in 25 years?
Well, I think, first of all, you shouldn't be wealthy to buy art. I mean, I think, there seems to be, what I've noticed is there seems to be more Audis and BMWs and Mercedes, more of an acquisitive lifestyle than there used to be. I mean, artwork is not like any other purchase. I mean, it's like buying a musical instrument. You can't justify it on the same level as buying a car or a designed suit. I think it's nourishment, and I think it's spiritual nourishment. So I encourage anybody at any level of discretionary income, and God knows we have a lot of friends who don't have that. Most galleries will put things away on time and no interest. You can make a crack at it.
Oh, they do that?
Yeah, yeah. You would be surprised.
How do you have to prove yourself?
You have to be enthusiastic.
Yeah.
It means so much to a gallerist that you even come in and that you notice anything. All the galleries in this town go to great efforts on a monthly or bi-monthly schedule to put on a really good show. And don't forget, this is free. The entry is free. You're coming into someone's home, if you will, and they're laying out a nice spread for you in terms of what you're able to see. It doesn't cost anything. But the idea that artwork is only the purview of the very wealthy is a misnomer. And some of the best collectors are the ones who have the least amount of money. They really look and they really care. And actually, I'll tell you, it probably means more to me than anybody who can just write a check without looking at their bank balance.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that the kind of art you show is hang-on-the-wall art, right, mostly? I mean, I guess Laura Fritz, you need a sort of a table or something.
Well, I do like to show some installation. We'll be showing in part this week when we open some of its parts. Part two, we'll have an installation by Fernanda D'Agostino, for example, who's just brilliant video and light. So, yes, I think people come to me because they want to acquire work that they're going to live with a long time. Generally, the rule of thumb is if you like it, someone else will like it down the road. If you really like it, if you buy it for investment, you're going to have a lot of money. And it's now you're talking about asset classes, and it's a whole different deal.
Mm-hmm. Is your idea of the best way to appreciate a piece of hang-on-the-wall art to have it in your home?
Well, I think there's different kinds of work. I mean, there's work that is very political and sometimes ugly and would be hard for you to live with in your sanctuary, but you need to see it. And really, museums and public institutions are tasked with showing that kind of work. Then there's work that you want to live with, and it's work that recharges your being. And that's going to be like the kind of food you like to eat or the company you like to keep or the music you like to listen to. It's going to be a very personal, as I said, engaging experience. But knowing your gallerist, knowing what kind of work they show or expressing your interests to them, they can help steer you in those directions that intrigue you. And of course, anything goes in the art world now. There is no one dominant style. There's people riffing on riffing on riffing. There's everything from heavy conceptual and appropriation art all the way to flower paintings. In that sense, there is no bad art. There's just work that doesn't work for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know? If someone's having a great experience with a flower painting, then good on them.
Is there really no one hot thing right now in, the Western world style?
I think we have a lot of critical art theory out there. And so we have things about relational aesthetics, and we have things about appropriation. And yeah, I guess I'm a young fogey in that regard. I do like to have work that, as I said, doesn't need to be explained to you for you to get it. You mm-hmm. should get it and then have it explained to you. You know, when I was with William Jameson, there was 2 art fairs a year in the world. And now there's 16 every weekend somewhere. So if you go to an art fair, you're going to see every kind of style from representational to abstract to conceptual to sculpture to miniatures, everything. Anything goes.
Mm-hmm. The show, The Sum of Its Parts, Part 2, ends on May the 9th. What's going to happen after that?
Well, I'm very excited to represent the estate of, I think, one of the most important artists out of the Northwest, a woman named Mary Henry, Mary Dill Henry, who died in 2009. Jane Beebe at PDX Contemporary showed her work for years here in Portland until she passed away. She lived in a small, reclusive studio up on Whidbey Island outside of Seattle. But instead of painting loons or Puget Sound watercolors, she actually worked on hard-edged abstract drawings and paintings all by herself, very much a loner, but with this very rigorous practice. And because she was a woman and because she was painting in the Northwest, of course she was forgotten and overlooked by the New York establishments. My lifelong goal now, my remaining life, to bring her work to the attention of all the museums in the world. And I will do a one-person show of Mary Henry in May and June.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be the next show.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Jeffrey Thomas. His show, The Sum of Its Parts 2, is on from March 25th through May the 9th at Jeffrey Thomas Fine Art. And that's at 2219 Northwest Raleigh. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Jeffrey.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Joseph, and good on KBOO for keeping it going, keeping it real.
Andy Warhol looks at screen. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol looks at screen. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with the KBOO Evening News.
Muy buenas tardes, esto es Tania Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte en español para el día 24 de marzo de 2015. Un avión de la compañía alemana Germanwings, que realizaba el trayecto entre Barcelona y Düsseldorf con 150 personas a bordo, se ha estrellado este martes en los Alpes franceses. Entre las víctimas hay españoles y pasajeros de otras nacionalidades, sobre todo alemanes y probablemente turcos. Según el Ministerio de Exterior francés, el accidentado es uno de los aviones más viejos de la compañía y aunque se ha negado que la edad del avión puede ser una causa, no se ha querido especular sobre los motivos del accidente. Según la agencia Reuters, el avión no emitió ninguna llamada de emergencia, sino que fue el controlador de la